The Universal Language, a Merlin fanfic by Srin, read by Sophon Isba. This story is part of Srin's Modern Reincarnation series, The Timing Verse. The main pairing of the Universal Language is Gwen Morgana, with secondary Gwen Merlin and Morgana with other partners. It is rated NC-17 for sexual content. It contains non-graphic reference to gay bashing of an original character and to other violence. Summary. In which Morgana remembers her history and seeks some manner of reconciliation with her present. Part 1. Some Memories. Incomplete. It seems that it is Morgana's lot in life, in lives, frankly, to know things before she is fully equipped to understand them, and to feel rather mad as a result. When she is 12 years old, she suddenly finds herself in the possession of a great deal of memories that seem to belong in a book more so than in her brain. There are castles and knights, dragons and warlocks, a man she hates but also loves, a man she loves but also hates, a girl she loves more than anything, and a boy, a magical boy with big ears and a kind face, who is also, somehow, her six-year-old brother, who's asleep in the room beside hers. And she would just think she's completely barmy, that something's broken inside her head, except she also remembers remembering. She remembers experiencing the same bewildering crush of recollection in a dozen different lifetimes, stretching back through history. And she remembers those other lives, too. Bits and pieces only, hazy snippets. Being married to Merlin, which is deeply disturbing, because he's her brother. Being married to Arthur. The blonde man's name is Arthur. Oh, God. Arthur and Merlin and Morgana. She must be insane. Being married to Arthur, which is weird and off-putting in a way she doesn't quite understand yet. And the girl. Gwen. Guinevere? Of course, why not? And that handsome dark-haired fellow in the background is probably Lancelot. Dear God. Gwen. She remembers Gwen. She remembers Gwen holding her while she had terrible nightmares. Gwen bringing her flowers. Gwen making her heart seize up and her stomach flutter. She remembers gazing at Gwen when she seemed not to be watching, and slipping away together to swim in secluded pools, and finding more wonder in one of Gwen's smiles than in 1,000 volumes of poetry. But she doesn't know Gwen. Merlin is her brother. Arthur is probably some obnoxious git in Merlin's year, but Gwen, she doesn't know any girls named Gwen, any girls who look like Gwen, any girls whose presence lifts her spirits like Gwen's always has. She wishes she did. Morgana doesn't tell anyone about these memories. What purpose would it serve? If she's mad, she doesn't want to be locked up, doesn't want to be fed medication to take away all of this. And even if she isn't mad, no one will believe her. But she can't keep all of this hidden in her head, either. So she digs around beneath her bed and finds a black and white composition book. The first few pages are occupied by a diary she began at age 10 and abandoned at age 10 and 1 week. The rest is blank. She writes in it, after her homework is finished, and on the weekends, and in the evenings. Writes until her hand is cramped and smudged with ink, scribbles down every memory, lest they leave her again. It's an incoherent jumble at first, but slowly the memories settle. Within a few weeks she can sort them into different lifetimes. Arrange them in broad chronological sweeps, and not feel absolutely insane for doing it. The picture she assembles of her first life, the one in Camelot, doesn't exactly match the legends, but if anything, this is reassuring. Surely, if she were fabricating all this, she would keep to what she thought she knew. One day, Morgana and Merlin go to the grocery store with their parents. Morgana's holding Merlin's hand, ostensibly keeping an eye on him, but really paying more attention to a display of flowers. Gwen used to bring her flowers, wild flowers she picked herself, not like these, cultivated and cut by impersonal hands, while their mother and father putter around, selecting fruits and vegetables. And then, all of a sudden, Merlin drops her hand and darts off in the direction of the dairy section, shouting in excitement, "Miss Elkins! Miss Elkins!" It's the teacher he had last year at school, the one he adored. Morgana follows him, her head spinning because the woman looks incredibly familiar. Morgana met her once last year, but that isn't it. She's someone from before, someone important to... "Oh, Huneth, I'm sorry," Morgana's mother says, intercepting Merlin just before he can throw himself at the woman. Merlin's pouting, reaching for her, and the teacher is smiling kindly and saying it's all right. She's pleased to see him again. But Morgana isn't paying attention to any of that because... Huneth, Merlin's mother. Her brother was once a warlock, near enough her own age, and her brother's teacher was once his mother. Later, when they're home and their parents are in another room, Morgana asks Merlin some questions. Roundabout things, oblique, trying to discover whether or not he remembers anything without being too obvious about it. He doesn't seem to, but then he is still very young. If she's remembered now, he may not until he's her age. Seeing Huneth has persuaded her anyway. Her memories are real. As time goes by, Morgana finds herself remembering more and more. The day her mother explains sex to her, she slides curious fingers between her legs in the shower, and that night she can suddenly recall Gwen's fingers touching her there, Gwen's mouth, Gwen's body naked and pressed up close to hers. She remembers this and wants it more than anything, her body aching for a release she can't seem to find by her own hand. Hours pass before she finally falls asleep, lonely and sweaty and frustrated. She still doesn't know anyone called Gwen, and there don't seem to be any boys, gits or otherwise, in Merlin's year that resemble Arthur. When she's 15, she remembers having sex with Arthur in one of the lives when they were married. She knows she loves him, knows she loved how he made her feel then, but now she's begun to suspect that she really isn't interested in boys this time around, and that particular memory confirms it. She misses Gwen more than ever, though she also begins to pay attention to the girls who are around. When she's 16, Merlin finds one of the magazines hidden under her bed. It's full of pictures of naked women, and she isn't sure what she dreads more, Merlin telling their parents that she has porn, or Merlin telling their parents she has porn intended for straight men. As it happens, Merlin doesn't tell their parents anything, just asks some awkward questions. "Why is that lady wearing shoes but no clothes? Why do you want pictures of naked girls when you can just look at yourself in the mirror? What's a cock, and why would anyone want to suck it?" And then agrees to keep her secret. They don't speak of it again, until the summer he turns 13, when he sheepishly wanders into her room one night and asks if he could maybe borrow one of her magazines. She lets him, too amused to mirror his embarrassment. The memories no longer seem so urgent as they did in her younger days. She still writes in her notebook whenever she remembers something new, or pieces a clearer picture together from some muddy details. But for the most part, Morgana focuses on the life she's living now. Her anger at the injustices of the world, the allure of pretty girls who aren't confined to magazine pages, telly and rugby and other mundane matters. Still, things don't quite fit. Or perhaps it's that Morgana doesn't quite fit in amongst them. She's happy enough, but perpetually a little unsatisfied, a little in need of something more. The world has always felt huge and enticing to Morgana, while England, particularly England without Gwen, without Arthur, without anyone to tie her here, England feels much too small and, at the same time, much too empty. She's too much older than Merlin to rely on him, as she sometimes has, and there's no magic left in the world, and he doesn't remember anyway. Perhaps she really is mad, or perhaps it's only a matter of time, but regardless, she can't stay here, when she turns every corner with a small part of her expecting a familiar face. She chooses to go to the United States for university, a small women's college in the mountains of New England. New England, the irony isn't lost on her. Her parents want to go with her, to see her settled in, but the thought of her family trailing her into her new world is one that makes her shudder, It works out in her favor. Her mom can't get off work. And the day her dad's planning to book his airfare over her protests, Merlin is violently sick in the bathroom and continues to be violently sick for the next week. She's fairly sure he's faking it for her benefit, and she whispers her thanks in his ear as she hugs him goodbye. He coughs loudly as she draws back, but there's something sheepish in his watery smile. There isn't much Morgana can take with her, given the limited baggage allowance, but that seems fitting somehow. Her flight leaves in the evening, chasing the sun into the western sky. She's met in Boston by an old friend of her mother's, spends the night in the woman's apartment, and in the morning she takes her backpack and two overstuffed suitcases on a bus headed into the mountains. The American money is at once boring and confusing, and she nearly gets run over twice in the first week because they drive on the wrong side, and she can't buy whiskey or even wine, and she doesn't know a single person in the entire bloody country. Her mother's friend doesn't count. Her mother's friend tried to pinch her cheeks and asked if she'd always wanted to be a lesbian. She regrets having come here for about a day. Then she starts to look around her, really look, at the mountains and the sunsets and the beautiful, beautiful girls, many of whom like girls as well, or are at least prepared to experiment vigorously until graduation. And then she doesn't regret it anymore. It's weird and a little wrong, but it's also right, at least for now. She doesn't expect to find anyone she remembers here, but that's fine, because she doesn't expect to. Which is why it's odd when she meets a professor she could swear was once her mother, and when a bloke in a coffee shop called Edwin sets her teeth on edge. Odd, and oddly comforting. The American accent's great on her ears at first, the R's too rough and heavy, the vowels all wrong. But she grows accustomed to them soon enough. She takes a course on linguistics on a whim, learns to read IPA and describe with precision what it is that's different about the way they speak here. One day, they discuss language change, and Morgana is startled by the realization that she's lived over and over again, all before any of these changes took place. The professor mentions that the Appalachian dialect is probably closer to what was spoken by Shakespeare than the BBC English favored by film and stage. A girl from West Virginia laughs, surprised and delighted, and Morgana pays more attention to her speech thereafter, but it doesn't seem any more familiar to her than anyone else's. Of course, Morgana and the others haven't spoken modern English throughout their history. Of course Morgana didn't sound like a Gloucester girl when she was born and raised in Glasgow, or Greenwich, or London, but it seems her memories have been translated, like an old text. It's odd to realize that she doesn't know how they talked in Camelot. She isn't sure when Camelot was, whether they would have spoken some muddled mixture of Anglo-Saxon and Norman French, or plain old English, or even Latin, or a lost Gaelic tongue. She does know that she can't understand any of those. She speaks modern English and some French, and that's all. What she remembers doesn't seem to fit into any real time that ever happened. Certainly there were no dragons when the Roman legions marched across Britain, and no tomatoes when Beowulf was written down, and no sorcerers when they started telling tales of Arthur, the legendary king. She thinks again that maybe it is all madness, that all these recollections of other lives are only the product of a damaged imagination, and then tries not to think of it. Her own accent is exotic here, a novelty. The captain of the rugby team flirts shamelessly, and when they tumble into bed together, she begs Morgana to speak, to say anything at all. Morgana does. She lets herself get lost in the exertion of the sport, the enticing swell of the girl's breasts, the stupid excitement of drinking underage. Never mind that at home she could buy anything she wants, that she's been allowed to buy beer as long as her roommate has been allowed to drive a car, and tries not to think about memories that may or may not be real. And then one night Merlin phones, half incoherent in his enthusiasm, and says he's remembered. And finally, her world feels a little fuller. He doesn't question the reality of the memories or his own sanity. He's always had an easier time of it. And while she sometimes begrudged him that, his unquestioning acceptance is a balm to her now. They talk about Gwen and about Arthur and about everything they both recall, and while Morgana plays it cool, because he is, still and all, her baby brother, she locks herself in the bathroom and cries with relief after they hang up. She feels freer afterwards. Despite her near continual efforts to keep the memories at the back of her mind, they've been weighing on her. All these years she's carried them alone. Now that Merlin remembers, now that they can speak of it all, compare notes, let their recollections out in the open, even if only with one another, it's as though a burden has been lifted from Morgana's shoulders. When the captain of the rugby team follows Morgana into the shower after practice the next day and drops to her knees on the wet tiles, Morgana doesn't think of Gwen at all. Part 2. Some Conversations by Phone, Inconvenient. After she graduates from university, Morgana travels the United States, sleeping on friends' couches until her visa expires, and then she spends 3 weeks in Canada doing the same. When she finally returns to England, it's no different than it's been going back in the summer, still too small, still too empty. Merlin's a comfort, and they spend hours discussing their history and laughing about how the legends got it wrong. But it still isn't enough. The fact that he's remembered doesn't change the fact that he's her baby brother, and in some ways she's glad of that, but... Her degree is in critical social thought, and she should probably do postgraduate work to turn it into something practical, but the thought of further schooling doesn't appeal at all. She doesn't want to sit in any more classrooms having intellectual discussions about what's wrong with the world. She wants to fix it. So she finds a job with an international aid organization, and 6 months after coming home, Morgana leaves England again, this time for a sexual and reproductive health clinic in Rwanda. Her parents and many of her friends from university think she's insane, but she never regrets it. Africa is nothing like England, and nothing like America, and that makes it perfect. For the next several years, she will shuffle between assorted jobs in assorted African countries, sometimes clinics like the one in Rwanda, sometimes educational efforts, sometimes simple labor, building schools and hospitals. She doesn't mind the primitive conditions she's often living in, doesn't mind the heat or the insects, or the fact that she has to rely on English and limited French when so many of the people around her are fluent in three languages, if not more. She cuts her hair short and learns enough of the local languages to get by, and that's that. Africa is big enough not to feel empty. Still, she changes jobs and locations often, rarely staying in one place longer than 6 months. She's happy so long as she feels she's making a difference, but frustration with the inability to do enough develops quickly, and anyway, people are often a little relieved when the strange Englishwoman decides to move on. Unexpectedly, she finds she enjoys the construction efforts the most. She's never really handled tools before, apart from the odd project around the house. But she learns quickly, and there's something remarkably satisfying about seeing a stack of raw materials transformed into a useful thing. People are often surprised that she wants to work so hard with her hands, making assumptions based on her background and stature, and she gets an added thrill out of proving them wrong. She's in Madagascar when Merlin begins university. He's going to Kent for English literature. She thinks their parents are pleased that he didn't share her inclination for fleeing to distant lands. It's been over a year since she was last home. She doesn't miss it. One night her phone goes off. It's Merlin's number, and she doesn't answer it, because it's nearly dawn. Odds are he's forgotten, again, both how the time difference works and that she isn't keeping a university student's hours. And even if it is important, there's really nothing she could possibly do at 5 in the morning on another continent. When she wakes up for the day, she checks the messages, expecting at best an anecdote about his roommate Roger, who is, apparently, in defiance of all logic, Gaius, reincarnated. Morgana! Morgana, pick up your bloody mobile! I don't care what time it is there. This is important. Morgana! I've met Gwen. She doesn't remember, but it's Gwen! Gwen! It's phone me, all right? It's God, she's doing architecture and she's beautiful and she just ring me back, yeah? She rings him back, not bothering to check what time it might be in England now, her heart pounding wildly against her ribs. Merlin, she says, and she feels the tremor in her voice, though she doesn't hear it. She's amazing, Merlin says immediately. She's from Ipswich. She's in the last year of her undergraduate, but she's staying here for her master's. She's doing architecture. She, God, Morgana, when we met, she asked if I knew any Arthurs or Lancelots, and she has an illegal cat in her flat, and he rambles on, and Morgana lets him, eyes closed, clutching the phone, feeling half numb and half elated. A part of her wants to book a flight back to England immediately, but she's signed a contract to remain here for another 4 months at least, and she can't break that commitment on a selfish whim, not even for Gwen. Especially not for Gwen. Gwen would be disappointed in her, and Gwen's disappointment would be far more painful to bear than the separation is. So she just stands there and lets Merlin talk until she can't justify being any later to work than she already is. A few weeks later, Merlin phones again. Please leave Africa right now and come here and seduce Gwen, Merlin says when she answers. I'm sorry. I think she's bi and she's not seeing anyone, and she keeps coming by on dodgy excuses, and it's not like I don't love seeing her, but I think she might have a thing for Roger, who is Gaius. And really, Morgana, there are some things I should not be expected to endure, and Gwen shagging Gaius in my room is one of them. Morgana drops the phone because she's laughing too hard. When she retrieves it, Merlin says, Seriously, though, you should meet Gwen. When you come back, you need to. And Morgana doesn't hesitate because she's been thinking about this, thinking about it every time she's fought the urge to phone Merlin and demand more information about Gwen, every time she's contemplated quitting and running home, every time she's had to shake herself out of a fantasy of strolling onto the campus and flinging herself into Gwen's arms. No, Morgana says. I mean, I can't just turn up at your school and barge into your life. If she doesn't remember, I've no reason that matters in this life to be there. It wouldn't be fair to her. I can't. Morgana, I couldn't bear it. If I came and she just shook my hand and smiled at me politely because I was your sister, I couldn't. I remember her. I love her. And she doesn't remember me either, Merlin says softly. Yes, but you have a reason to be in her life. Her life, this life, now. I don't. I'd be there because of who she was, not who she is, and that isn't fair. When she remembers, or if you bring her home, if I'm back in the country, then. But I can't just. I can't. All right. Merlin, do you. If it were Arthur, if I'd found him working here and he didn't. No, you're right. I get it. I do, Morgana. I'm sorry. It isn't your fault. Just when she remembers, phone me. I will. A month later, when she's in Cape Town with friends for the weekend, Merlin phones her again, and Morgana's heart feels like it wants to burst out of her chest. Did she? No, I. Morgana, Gwen is. She still doesn't. But I. What's wrong? She. I think I'm sort of in love with her. With Gwen. And she. I thought she was after Roger, but she is actually. She likes me. She kissed me, and I. God, Morgana, I'm so sorry. I am so sorry. Oh. She says, very quietly. Her heart doesn't want to burst out of her chest anymore. In fact, she isn't sure if it's even still present. Morgana, it's fine, she says. You're there. You're there. I'm not. You. Take care of her, all right? Promise me you'll take care of her? Of course, I. Morgana, it's fine, she repeats. I have to go. She doesn't have to go, not really, but she really, really does. She ends the call and sits there, staring at the phone, for a very long time. Then she gets dressed in all her sexiest things and goes out to a club and lets men hit on her all night while she watches the women and pretends that everything's all right. She could go to a gay bar. There are gay bars in Cape Town. And she could probably pick up a girl, maybe even a girl who looks a little like Gwen, or sounds a little like Gwen, or smiles a little like Gwen. But she doesn't. It wouldn't be fair to the girl, and she can't do it to herself. Not tonight, when all she can think of is Gwen, sweet, oblivious Gwen, with her stupid little brother, who she can't quite bring herself to hate even now. A week after, she phones Merlin. Morgana, he says, sounding frightened and guilty. I'm not angry with you, she says. This is not entirely true, but it is true enough. Morgana, how is she? Happy. She's happy. Stressed because it's exams now, and I told you she's 2 years ahead of me, so she's finishing her bachelor's, and this one course of hers is... But she's happy. Do you want to know this? Morgana closes her eyes, takes a deep breath, and says, yes. When she kissed me the first time, I freaked out a little, and I said there was something I needed to clear up, but I told her it was sorted after we talked, and she just, you know how when she smiles, really smiles, it's like the sun came out? Yes. But she doesn't know, really, because she's never seen Gwen in this life. There are pictures of her on the internet, but there aren't any computers in the tiny village she's staying in, and she couldn't bring herself to look when she was in Cape Town. She remembers knowing, like she remembers knowing how to ride a horse. She tried once in America and failed miserably. Like she remembers conversations that must have occurred in some forgotten Middle English dialect, but she doesn't know. When her stint in Madagascar ends, Morgana goes back to England for 2 weeks. It's too cold, too damp, too full of people all speaking the same language, but she doesn't mind, because now England has Gwen in it. She doesn't meet Gwen, because it's summer, and Gwen's on holiday with her family. But Gwen's there. Gwen is a real person now, no longer just a series of well-loved and well-worn memories. Morgana sees Merlin's pictures of her, listens to his stories. After a few awkward conversations, they've settled into a way of talking about her. Merlin doesn't mention anything to do with their romance, and Morgana doesn't ask. And though there's a tightness in her heart and an itch in her skin, it's all right. Gwen is happy with Merlin. They've always made one another happy. They've married more than once, in other lives, and always been dear friends. And for all that Morgana longs and aches, it's enough to know that Gwen's happy. Gwen has Merlin, and Morgana has Africa. Her next job is at a refugee camp in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. She's been there before, not in this life, but in the last. She can remember scattered pieces of wandering the continent in the 1960s, of meeting Lancelot in Elizabethville, of laying with Gwen in a rough hut in the jungle, clinging together despite the damp heat sticking to their skin and slowing their movements. She passes through Kinshasa and feels a zing of recognition. They stayed in that hotel. They saw those buildings. They ate in a restaurant that used to be where this other one is now. A lot has changed, of course. She was here 40 years ago, and isn't that strange to think, when she's only in her 20s now? The things they did in Africa. She thinks they died in Africa. The latest thing she can recall of her last life is being in Mauritius in 1968. Maybe they went back to England after, or to America. She thinks Arthur and Merlin were in America then. But she doesn't think so. There's a fragment of a memory. Violence and blood and Gwen at her side. And there's a sense of finality about it. She can't remember death, not any of them. But she suspects that moment did not precede it by very much. It's unsettling to dwell on, but she finds herself dwelling on it a lot whilst in the Congo. She's never done this sort of work before, always development aid rather than crisis aid, and as much as orphaned children and abused women tear at her soul, seeing the haunted eyes of people forced to abandon their homes and flee for their lives is another thing entirely. Her phone doesn't get reception here, so she speaks to Merlin only once a month or so, when she steals 5 minutes on the satellite phone late at night to let him, and by extension their parents, know she's all right. She doesn't mind the lack of contact. She's more isolated from the world here than she has been anywhere else, and she doesn't really want to talk to anyone who doesn't understand. The conditions are dirty and depressing, the people desperate, the supplies and staff inadequate, and the university life in Kent seems far more than half a world away. She's supposed to be there 6 months, but instead she stays 9, unwilling to abandon the people or the work, and only leaves when she takes ill and gets carted off to a hospital in Kinshasa while delirious with fever. They try to convince her to go home, but she won't, can't stand the thought of convalescing in England, with her parents constantly hovering, and Gwen so close, yet still so out of reach. Merlin would visit, and he'd bring Gwen with him, and she would not crawl into Morgana's bed and hold her, as she so often did before. She would bring him personal flowers, perhaps, and polite wishes for her health, and Morgana could not stand it. Instead, she makes arrangements to stay with a friend from university who lives in Cape Town, which isn't ideal, but it's better than leaving the continent. While she's resting, sleeping on Zanani's fold-out couch, listening to the hum of the air conditioning, she dreams a great deal, slapdash mosaics of memory scattered throughout her mind. Gwen in the 60s, the children from the camp, Evelyn at the consulate in Madagascar, with whom Morgana had a terribly low-key affair while she was in the country. A girl Morgana lived with for a while in another lifetime, her name lost to history. A hut in the Congo, a hut in India, a hut in France during the war. Which war? It could be the Great War. She was a nurse then. Or it could be one of the countless other conflicts down the centuries. A dirty hut and fighting, and Arthur dying on the battlefield, and Merlin shattered in his grief. How many times has that happened? A hut in France, a hut in England, Gwen in a hut in England. And God knows when that was, because it's only a fragment, and all she remembers is Gwen, naked and beautiful and safe on a dingy bed in a dingy room, and the scent of flowers in the air. Gwen. Gwen in Merlin's pictures. Gwen in Camelot. Gwen shifting into girls Morgana's taken back to her hotel on other trips to Cape Town. Gwen swinging a hammer in a forge, and people from Morgana's building project swinging hammers under the sun, sweat and tears and blood, love and death and loneliness, and trying, always trying, never able to do enough. She wakes up once, startled by the sight of her breasts, because she's been dreaming about her life in the 50s, about wrapping bandages around her chest and dressing like a man, talking like a man, smoking like a man, about coming home to Gwen, who wore dresses as was proper and met the world as a woman and quietly defied its expectations anyway, about smoking something other than cigarettes and talking about revolution, a new decade and a new era, about running away from England then too, but doing it hand in hand with Gwen. Zanani tells her she's been muttering strange things in her sleep, and Morgana smiles and blames the fever. Once she's recovered, assorted complications prevent her from returning to the Congo, so Morgana goes to Mali instead, to work in another clinic. The illness has left her muddled, because she hasn't thought so much about her old lives since the first time she came home after Merlin remembered. Now they're all stirred up in her head again, the nearly complete recollections of Camelot, and her memories of her own youth, and all the scraps and shards of all the lives in between, all weighing her down as though her head's too full. Maybe it is. She's tired, tired and frustrated, but her temper burns more slowly now, which makes the clinic manageable. Her French is much better than it once was, and the clinic is well stocked, and she gets by. She thinks she found patience somewhere in those fever dreams, or maybe it's only the weight of the memories slowing her down. And then, one day a few months in, Morgana sees a boy being harassed by other boys in the street. She recognizes him because he's been in the clinic a few times. He's gay, she knows, and it's clear that that's the problem. Such intolerance is a fact of life here. She learned long ago to keep her own sexuality quiet outside of the odd safe space, in embassies or consulates or in Cape Town. But she's never accepted it, and something inside her snaps today, and her slow-burning temper flares up. She interferes. The boy she knows is bewildered and angry, but she can see he's a little grateful, too. The others are furious and disgusted with her, strange white woman getting involved where she has no business and no right. It gets ugly fast and violent, and then the police turn up and arrest everyone. There are interrogations and arguments and awkward interviews with embassy staff she's never met before, and it's an infuriating mess, but ultimately the fallout is this. She won't be prosecuted, but she has to leave Mali. And then there are more arguments, because everyone's telling her to go back to England when that's the last thing she wants. But then, finally, there's a phone call from the woman who's her sort of boss with the aid organization she's been working for all these years. "I understand I have to leave here," Morgana says, trying to sound more patient than she feels. "But I don't see why I can't just..." "Morgana, there is no way you'll be able to get a visa right now. Not for any place we can use you. Perhaps in a few years, but not now." "But not without tying up money and lawyers that could be doing much more good elsewhere. Is that what you want?" That silences Morgana. She sags in her chair and breathes deeply, trying not to get angry, because it isn't Tabitha's fault that she's in this situation. "What am I supposed to do, then?" "Go back to England, see your family. There's an office in London that does children's aid in particular. I'll make a few calls. I'm sure they'd be happy to have you, provided you don't mind the city. Where are you from again?" "Gloucester, but it's been years since I properly lived there. London is fine." "Good. Book a flight, and I'll be in touch." "Tabitha, I'm sorry." "Don't be," Tabitha says, her voice a little kinder now. "You're hardly the first to be deported for fighting the fight, whatever the fight may be." On her last night in Africa, Morgana climbs up on the roof of the embassy building to watch the sunset. It isn't the most spectacular sunset she's seen in Africa, but it'll do, the sky blazing orange in the west. She stares at the sky and wonders what she'll remember of this life in the next. Will it be this sunset, unremarkable but for what it symbolizes? Or will it be the face of the boy she defended? Or will it be Zanani's couch, or the tents in the Congo, or her freshman dorm, or Merlin borrowing her porn, or the first time she remembered? Or will it be something so insignificant that she doesn't even think of it now, that will make her wonder what it ever meant, because she can't recall that it didn't mean anything? It would be absurd to expect to remember everything, of course. People can barely keep track of one lifetime. But she finds it deeply infuriating that the whole process is so bloody random, that her head's stuffed full of stupid things like tying her men's loafers in 1955 and churning butter in some vague pre-industrial period, while she doesn't even know where exactly she was born last time, or what Gwen thought about the Beatles, or where Merlin and Arthur were while she and Gwen rambled around the world. It's ridiculous, and it's just one more thing that's wrong that she can't fix, no matter how hard she tries. Part 3. Some Conversations in Person. Inconclusive. Morgana's in England for a week before she tells anyone she's back, and even then it's only a brief phone call to Merlin to inform him that she's working out of London now. A few hours after that, she receives an annoyed phone call from her mother, demanding to know why she wasn't informed immediately when Morgana was back in the country. Morgana makes vague excuses, and then pretends that her battery is dying so she can hang up. Acclimating to life in England again is trying enough without lectures from her parents, and she isn't quite prepared to actually see anyone yet. Still, eventually she does have to start work, not least because aid work doesn't pay much, and though she doesn't have a student debt thanks to scholarships, she doesn't really have any substantive savings either. The work is all right, a lot of phone calls, a lot of paperwork, but sometimes she gets to write scathing letters, and sometimes she gets to work on publicity materials designed to make executives feel guilty for buying a new MP3 player instead of donating to needy children, and that's satisfying enough. It isn't what she was doing in Africa, but she doesn't expect it to be. She gets a tiny flat and sleeps on her IKEA sofa until she can finally face going to her parents' house to collect her things. As uncomfortable and awkward as the visit is, though, it seems to snap the shell she crawled into somewhere on the plane out of Africa. When she gets back to London, she looks up the people she knows there and starts going out. By summer, 3 months after her return, Morgana has a social life and a flat that feels like home, and even this woman that she's sleeping with on a regular basis. And then Merlin calls to tell her Gwen's remembered. Which is all right. She's already taken a few days off to go to Kent next week because he's finishing university, and she'll meet Gwen then. There's no need to demand he put her on the phone now. I'd put her on, Merlin says. Only we spent hours talking after, and she's got this exam, so she's run off to the library, and you're coming, right? For graduation? She really wants to see you. I'm coming, Morgana says. The first time Gwen sees Morgana, she doesn't immediately recognize her. Everyone is milling around after Merlin's graduation ceremony, and she's heading over to say hello to Merlin's parents, and there's this woman talking to Merlin's mother. She has dark hair that's at that awkward length, too long to be left alone, too short to be tied back neatly. It's tucked into a messy tail, strands falling out to frame her face, somehow elegant in spite of the disarray. Her skin is tanned dark, too. 5 years in Africa, of course. And while Gwen knows that Merlin's sister is here somewhere, she doesn't make the connection. Not until Morgana turns and spots her. And her half smile slides off her face to be replaced by an expression of such fragile, naked wonder that Gwen feels the need to hide it away and protect it from the world. It only lasts a moment before the mask Gwen remembers well slides into place, but it's a moment Gwen will keep with her throughout this lifetime and find again in many others. Morgana recognizes Gwen instantly, and it's like being inside one of her broken memories. All context stripped away, so all she can see is this instant, Gwen in a yellow sundress and a white cardigan, her hair down and her smile warm and surprised, standing right there in front of Morgana. Close enough to reach out and touch, and she probably would, except context comes pouring back in then. She can't reach out and touch, because they've never met before. Merlin is possibly the most unsubtle man in the world. He introduces them, loudly suggests that maybe his sister and his girlfriend could keep one another company while he has dinner with the parents, and then plasters a big stupid grin on his face and drags the parents away with him after their mother asks why they don't all eat together. Mum is sputtering and Dad's trying to argue and throwing them curious glances, and Morgana doesn't think she's ever loved her ridiculous baby brother as much as she does just now. Where shall we go? Morgana asks, trying to keep the tremor out of her voice. I'm honestly a bit skint at the moment, Gwen says, looking embarrassed. Would you mind terribly if we just did the chip shop near my flat? Morgana wouldn't mind terribly if Gwen said, let's just eat this gum I found on my shoe. Morgana's heart is hammering against her ribs, and she feels the same terrifying elation as she did the first time she stepped off a plane onto African soil. And it's really all she can do to retain even the slightest bit of composure. That would be lovely, Morgana says. Gwen drives. Morgana arrived with her parents and doesn't own a car, and it's just as well because she wouldn't trust herself to drive right now anyway. It's strange, though, because as jittery and mad as she feels, actually talking to Gwen is as easy as breathing. They discuss the ceremony, and Gwen rambles a bit about her ongoing master's project. And Morgana drinks her voice in and feels as though she's dreaming some memory of another life, when things were always like this, when she hadn't spent 15 years longing for someone she's only just met. They park and order their food, and, because it's a pleasant evening, sit at one of the little tables outside. "You've been in Africa, then?" Gwen asks. "Doing what exactly? Merlin's always rather flippant, saying you're saving the world one homeless AIDS orphan at a time, and so on. And it's not that I don't believe you're trying to save people, but it sounds like, I mean, I don't mean to imply, no, he exaggerates," Morgana says, cutting her off and trying not to smile at the warm curl of familiarity that Gwen's babbling brings up in her belly. "He's probably vague because he doesn't remember what I'm actually doing at any given time. I changed jobs a lot, and locations. It's a wonder he could keep track of what country I was in, really." "Why did you move so much?" I suppose I do want to save the world, but of course one person can't. I get frustrated, because I can't do enough. And when I'm frustrated, I start to... I did sexual and reproductive health clinics, sometimes, but never for very long, because after a few months I couldn't help picking fights with men who didn't want their wives using contraceptives, that sort of thing. Or I did education, and that's just heartbreaking after a while, because these children, I really do want to help them all, really help them, not just teach them to read or do arithmetic, but the resources. And the construction jobs just end, you know? We build the school or the hospital, and then it's done. So I went elsewhere. "That's remarkable, though," Gwen says earnestly. "I mean, whatever Merlin says, you are helping, while we're just taking our courses for our own benefit. And Merlin said you do volunteer work." "Oh, well, I mean, Habitat for Humanity over the summer, just locally. I like working with my hands, and it's, you know, building low-cost housing. It's helping people, but that's not glamorous and exotic, like traipsing around Africa," Morgana says. And Gwen stops and looks embarrassed. "I didn't mean... Gwen, don't sell yourself short. You're... just don't. I went to Africa because I didn't want to go to school anymore, and I wanted to get out of England. It isn't... I liked it there. I'm not some saint, and it wasn't all selfless." Gwen frowns still, and stabs a chip with her fork, but just says, "What made you leave?" Morgana hesitates, because she hasn't told anyone about the fight or the arrest. She simply covered her bruises in makeup until they faded and made vague allusions to politics and exhaustion to explain her return. Merlin looks at her like he knows it's a lie when it comes up, but he also knows better than to ask too many questions when it's clear she doesn't want to discuss something. She considers lying now, but it's Gwen. They've only just met and barely talked of anything, but it's still Gwen. "It wasn't entirely voluntary, I'm afraid. I was arrested in Mali, and though I managed to avoid prosecution, I had to leave the country, and after that, it was just better for everyone that I come back here." "Arrested?" Gwen asks, blinking rapidly. Merlin didn't say anything about... "No, he wouldn't have. Merlin doesn't know. I didn't... Our parents don't know either. I didn't tell anyone." "You told me," Gwen says softly. "Yes," says Morgana, feeling a little shaky. "Yes." Gwen smiles a little, looking touched, and Morgana smiles back. "Can I ask what you were arrested for?" "There was a fight. Some boys were harassing someone I knew, and I tried to help him, and things got a bit out of hand."
"And they deported you for that?"
"He's gay, the boy. That's why they were going after him, and there aren't any protections there. It was fighting in public that we were arrested for, all of us. But as far as they're concerned, he was at fault, and I was, for helping him."
"Oh," says Gwen, and then she adds, "Well, I suppose it's good it was a worthy cause and not public indecency or something. Do you remember that time in Paris when we were with the wine and the mime and the poor policeman?"
"Yes," Morgana says, a little too loudly, but too delighted to care. Delighted at the memory, but more so at the fact that it's Gwen remembering it. That time in Paris happened during their last lifetime, in the early 1960s, and it's one of dozens of memories that Morgana's never discussed, even with Merlin, because it's personal, just her and Gwen. And now she can discuss it. Just her and Gwen.
Do you want to go back? Gwen asks, when they've finished laughing over the recollection. No, Morgana thinks. You aren't there. But she doesn't think it's fair to say that, not so early. I didn't want to leave, she says. But now I don't know. I bought a couch, and I've these things in my flat that I haven't looked at since I packed them away before university, and I don't know. But you'll be here, for a while at least, Gwen asks, sounding hopeful, and Morgana's heart flutters madly. In England, I mean, Gwen continues. Not Kent, obviously. You've no reason. You're here through the summer? Morgana interrupts, afraid of what else Gwen might say, afraid Gwen will say something self-deprecating, and then she won't be able to stop herself from arguing against it much too passionately. Yes, until September, and then I'm moving to Southampton. I have an internship with an architect's firm there. Merlin's going, too. I don't know if he told you? Morgana feels as though a weight's been dropped into her stomach. She shouldn't be surprised, of course not. They've been together for 2 years. It isn't as though she expected them to break up just because she's back and Gwen's remembered, but apparently a small part of her did expect just that. She suspects she ought to be ashamed of that. She isn't certain whether she is. He mentioned he was relocating in August, but if he said where, it slipped my mind. You're going together then? What? Oh, no. No, no, he has a job there as well. And we talked about sharing a flat, but the locations and all, it just didn't make any sense. I've this tiny place arranged, right downtown, near the firm, and he's splitting a bigger one with some mates, near where he'll be working. Ah, says Morgana, trying to swallow her inappropriate relief. I think this is the point where you, as his lovely and patient sister, tell me some embarrassing anecdotes to illustrate why I wouldn't want to live with Merlin anyway, Gwen suggests with a small smile, as though she understands exactly what Morgana's thinking, and Morgana laughs, and the tension bubbles away with it. Can I see you again? Morgana asks later, feeling shy in a way she hasn't experienced since the first time she asked a girl out in secondary school. Of course, Gwen says, seeming surprised by the question. That night, after Gwen's dropped Morgana at her hotel, Merlin comes over to Gwen's. When she opens the door, he flings his arms around her and kisses her with such longing and desperation that it makes her chest ache. Merlin, what? So you've met Morgana, he says, still holding her. Oh, well, yes. And? Well, she's Morgana. And? Gwen bites her lip, because she knows what he's asking, and she doesn't especially want to answer him. I suppose threesomes would be out of the question, she asks, her tone as innocent as possible. She's my sister, Merlin says, pulling a disgusted face. We could film it, make millions on the internet, and never have to work again, Gwen suggests. That gets her a laugh, and then she starts teasing him about his graduation robes, and it's fine, except she really wishes threesomes weren't out of the question, because she loves them both a little too much. Merlin too much to be willing to hurt him, Morgana too much to stay away from her. A week later, Morgana meant to wait too, but couldn't. Morgana takes the train to Kent again, and they meet for tea. So, tell me about your girlfriend, Gwen says, watching Morgana closely, her face direct and honest. Morgana peers into her cup, because she's not quite prepared to be so open. None of the things Gwen might see in her eyes would be fair to display like that, given their current circumstances. Girlfriend might be a bit of an exaggeration, Morgana says, trying to keep her tone light. Her name is Imelda, and she's Swiss. A physicist, looks like a lingerie model. I'm fairly convinced she does not actually possess a soul, and I really need to break things off one of these days. Why haven't you, if she lacks a soul? Gwen asks. She sounds amused and curious, and not at all jealous, the way Morgana would maybe not so secretly like her to be. Because she is the most cunning linguist I have ever had the pleasure of knowing, Morgana says, hiding her smirk behind her cup. Didn't you say she's a... Oh! Gwen starts out frowning and then laughs and ducks her head when she gets it. Morgana thinks it's one of the most endearing things she's ever seen, and she has to remind herself that leaping over the table to kiss Gwen senseless would not be an acceptable course of action, not least because Gwen's still with Merlin and Morgana's still with Imelda, lack of soul notwithstanding. Instead, she suppresses a flare of resentment towards her brother. If Gwen were with anyone else, because Arthur's never tried to keep her to himself when they've been together, and Lancelot would throw himself in front of a lorry to save Gwen frowning, so he wouldn't make a fuss so long as Gwen were happy, Morgana wouldn't hesitate to bring out her full arsenal of charm and try to seduce Gwen anyway. But it's Merlin. Merlin, who's her baby brother. Merlin, who hasn't got Arthur or Lancelot or Will, or even Gaius, since Roger doesn't remember and he's left the country anyway. Merlin, who phoned and asked if it was all right with her before he took up with Gwen in the first place, when she was too scared to face a Gwen who would look at her without recognition. Merlin, who introduced her and Gwen with a smile on his lips and a look in his eyes like he knew he'd already lost Gwen. No, she can't do that to Merlin. Not deliberately. She's very talented, and I find I prefer brilliant sex and no soul to no sex, period. Morgana says, keeping her voice as bland as possible. And I suppose sex and a soul is out of the question? Gwen asks. She's grinning, but there's a look in her eyes that sets Morgana's heart to fluttering and almost makes her hope. I have my doubts, but I'm open to the possibility, she says carefully, and Gwen meets her gaze, intent enough to take Morgana's breath away. They have dinner with Merlin, which isn't as awkward as Morgana thought it might be. The three of them fall easily into the old rhythms of banter and snark, and it's the most at home Morgana has felt since returning to England. Merlin's her brother, her stupid little brother, who's dating the love of her lives, and that makes it easy to forget just how dear he really is to her. But sharing a meal and laughter like this makes for an excellent reminder. She thinks she could learn to be happy like this, with Gwen's friendship, even if she can't have anything more. Still, when Gwen hugs her just before she gets on the last train back to London, she's startled and a little overwhelmed, and letting go rather than pulling Gwen closer and kissing her is nearly impossible. I'm glad you're here, Gwen says quietly. I missed you. I mean, missed isn't quite the word. We hadn't even met, but I know what you mean, Morgana tells her. They're on the phone together for at least an hour every day of the following week, and at the weekend, Gwen comes to London. She prowls around Morgana's flat, commenting on various design elements and the way the windows have been put in, and Morgana doesn't understand most of it, except about the windows. She put in her fair share of windows in Africa, but she doesn't mind. She's never minded Gwen talking, regardless of the subject, and it's wonderful to watch the way she lights up when she's speaking of something she loves. Your blank yet attentive stare is much better than Merlin's, Gwen tells her, smiling. I'm better than Merlin at a lot of things, Morgana says without thinking. She's too preoccupied with the curve of Gwen's lips to keep her verbal filter in place. Gwen looks uncomfortable for a scant moment, and Morgana feels guilty, but then Gwen laughs and says, That wouldn't be hard with some things. I love the man dearly, but if I never had to eat his scrambled eggs again, Are they still that bad? Morgana asks, joining in the laughter. I don't think I've been subjected to them in 10 years. I would have thought, I think they're actually getting worse. The morning after we... Gwen cuts herself off, that uncomfortable look back again, and corrects, The first summer we knew each other, he made me breakfast once, and it was actually quite good, but since then... The morning after you had sex? Morgana supplies. Which probably isn't fair, but she doesn't really want to spend the little time she gets with Gwen talking about her brother's bad eggs. Not that she really wants to talk about Gwen having sex with Merlin, either, but every accidental allusion either of them makes is like a thorn under Morgana's skin, prickling all the more when she tries to ignore it. Yes, Gwen says, ducking her head and frowning at her shoes. It's all right, Gwen, really. It's not as though I don't know you two or... Morgana waves a hand, vaguely, unwilling to make herself say it. No, of course, but you... But he's your brother. You don't want to hear about me and him, Gwen says. She meets Morgana's gaze, and it's clear they both know that Merlin isn't the issue at all.
It's all right, Morgana repeats. Gwen bites her lip and then says,
No, it's not, Morgana. I only remembered a few weeks ago, but you... And I know you've been in Africa mostly, but you've been back sometimes. And why did I only meet you at Merlin's graduation?
And that's the thing about Gwen. She's always been straightforward, where Morgana's all twisted up. Honest, where Morgana would be given to mislead. Morgana never expected to have this conversation, because she would never bring it up, never want to admit to it. And the Gwen in her imagination never asks anything she doesn't want to answer. But of course the real Gwen asks. Of course the real Gwen wants, deserves, to know.
I was frightened, Morgana says, stumbling over half a dozen possible answers in her mind before retreating to the truth. I was too frightened to face you when you would look at me and only see a stranger. Gwen's face crumples at that, her stern expression replaced by a soft mess of emotion, and before Morgana can react, Gwen comes forward to wrap Morgana in her arms.
I would have known you, Gwen says, quiet and certain. I could never not know you.
I'm sorry, Morgana says, clinging to her, overwhelmed by Gwen's assurance, by the embrace, by the visceral memory of countless other such embraces through their history. She's been able to recall Gwen holding her this way for more than half her life, has been wearing out the memory of the brief hug at the train station for the last week, but that's nothing to having Gwen right here, warm and solid, and making no move to pull away.
It's all right, Gwen says. I just wanted to know.
I'm sorry, Morgana says again, not knowing what else to say.
Hey, stop that, Gwen says gently. I've met you now, haven't I? That's all that matters.
Gwen sleeps on Morgana's couch that night. Morgana has a bed now, which she offered to Gwen, but Gwen refused to evict her from her own room, and Morgana bit her tongue before she could accidentally suggest that they share it, and goes home in the afternoon, with another hug that lasts a bit too long, has them pressed a bit too close together. That leaves Morgana keyed up and more than a little turned on, and she's about to dig out her vibrator to take care of things when her phone rings. It's Imelda. Morgana has not seen Imelda since meeting Gwen, because they both have jobs and Morgana's been spending every weekend with Gwen and every evening on the phone with Gwen. She feels somewhat guilty answering, and feels even guiltier when Imelda comes to her flat, shoves her down on the couch, drags her jeans and underwear off, and starts licking her. Then she doesn't feel much of anything apart from bliss for a good while, because Imelda really is very good at this. And then, when Morgana's thighs are still quivering with the aftershocks of her orgasm, Imelda sits back on her heels, wipes her mouth, and says, Morgana, you're lovely and all, but I really don't think this is working out. Morgana blinks at her a few times, and then says, Do you always eat people out before breaking up with them? Imelda shrugs, smiling slightly. I like to end things on a high note. Also, I find people are less likely to cry or throw things in a post-coital daze.
Fair enough, Morgana concedes.
She finds that she likes Imelda more in this moment than she has since the first time Imelda got her off, which says something about the quality of the relationship, really.
So you're okay? Imelda asks.
Yes. I'm sorry? Morgana tries and fails not to think of Gwen and yesterday as she says this.
Don't be, Imelda tells her, unconcerned.
And that's that. Imelda leaves, and Morgana stays where she is, bare-arsed on the couch and slightly bemused. When she gets up, she does so to book her train fare to Kent for the following weekend. She doesn't tell Gwen about Imelda, because she can't think of a way to mention it without sounding as though she expects Gwen to hurry up and dump Merlin. Gwen and Merlin are perfectly happy together. If sometimes it seems that Gwen speaks of him more as a friend than as a lover, that's surely only wishful thinking on Morgana's part. On Saturday, when Morgana's puttering around Gwen's kitchen, making dinner for the two of them, Gwen says, I found this grave once. I was little. We were on a trip somewhere in Scotland, Glasgow or maybe Edinburgh, I don't remember, in this churchyard, because Mum thought we had some relatives buried there, and I wandered off, and I found this grave. I was walking along, and it just, I felt something. Something pulled me there. The headstone was very eroded. I couldn't make out much, except Guinevere, beloved wife of L.A. something. And I remember, I thought, wouldn't it be funny if her husband was Lancelot? Guinevere and Lancelot, like in the stories. Do you suppose that was us? In Scotland? Morgana asks. I think, do you remember the years? 18th century, maybe, or 19th? I remember the house we had in the Victorian years, but it wasn't in Scotland. No, that was, if it was 18th century, it might have been. Hang on, I have a, watch this a minute, will you? Gwen nods, coming to the stove, and Morgana goes to her bag for her composition book. She's taken to bringing it with her whenever she's going to see Merlin or Gwen, just in case. She flips through it, searching for the relevant section, and then says, Yes, Merlin and I worked it out. We all lived in Glasgow in the 17th or 18th century. Neither of us remembers very much about that life. We only know it was Glasgow because I recognized the cathedral. So I found my own grave, Gwen says. God, that's weird, that there's this woman buried in the ground who used to be me, and I stumbled on it as a kid. And it's not just the one, is it? There are others, there have to be others, because we've lived so many times, and we've always... She stops, and somehow looks even more serious than she did a moment ago. It's always been you and me. Gwen. Tell me what you remember, Gwen says. I want to know what you remember about us. Tell me yours, and I'll tell you mine. Gwen, some of it's very... Explicit? Gwen asks. Because I know some of the things I remember. Gwen, I broke up with Merlin, Gwen says abruptly. On Friday, after spending 2 hours on the phone with Morgana, Gwen said, Merlin, I'm so sorry, but I have to. You're leaving me for Morgana, Merlin said, and his eyes were resigned, but he was smiling. You're my best friend. You always will be. But she, Gwen, it's okay. I understand. We had a good time, yeah? But I've known this was coming since you met her. Since you remember it, even. And that broke her heart a little. But she just pulled him into her arms and sighed. We did have a good time. We still will. I'm not going to abandon you just because. I never thought you would, Merlin said. His voice warm and sincere. Good. You know, this all could have been avoided if you'd only agreed to a threesome. Yeah, see, it's a good job we're done, Gwen, because some of these kinks are yours. And then he laughed, and she laughed, and she kissed him chastely on the mouth, and that was that. What? Morgana says. It's always been us, every time, Gwen says. I've loved lots of people. I still love Merlin. I always will. But you, it's always been you. When we met, I thought maybe we were only going to be friends this time, because everything's a bit cocked up. Did you know Merlin had Gaius for a roommate? And I thought that was rubbish, frankly, because I bloody well loved you in every life we've ever had, and it took me about 10 minutes to fall completely and hopelessly for you in this one, and then she stops talking, because Morgana's kissing her. Part 4. Some Pieces of a Life, Intrepid. Morgana's kissing Gwen. Morgana has Gwen's face cupped in her hands, and their lips pressed hot and wet together, and Gwen's hugging her tightly around the waist, and there isn't even a hint of propriety about it, and Morgana isn't dreaming or remembering or wishing it. She just is. "Imelda left me," Morgana says, breathless, when Gwen turns to mouth along her jaw. "Thank God," Gwen says, laughing, equally breathless. "Anyone who would leave you is clearly severely unhinged, and you deserve but—" Morgana cuts her off with another kiss, feeling lightheaded and delirious and too happy to stay inside her skin, and all of that again tenfold when Gwen's tongue slides past her teeth, and again when Gwen reaches for the hem of her skirt, tugging it off. And then she takes half a second to wish she'd worn a more interesting bra, but the way Gwen's looking at her. "God, you... Hang on, the stove." "I don't care about the stove," Morgana says, incredulous, reaching for Gwen again. But Gwen steps back and gives her the filthiest smile she's ever seen and says, "I don't either, but I don't want the fire brigade interrupting once I've got the rest of your clothes off." And that, well, Morgana can't argue with that. Gwen switches the stove off, takes Morgana by the hand, and leads her into the bedroom. Gwen's illegal cat is perched on the bed, but the creature takes one look at the two women and bolts from the room. "Clever thing," Gwen says fondly, and then she turns and looks at Morgana again. Morgana feels self-conscious under the heat of Gwen's gaze, because she isn't the pale, flawless lady she's been in some of their other lives. She has a mess of tan lines from t-shirts and different tank tops, and she hasn't shaved for a while because she fell out of the practice in Africa, and Imelda never cared about body hair, and her bra is a worn neutral one, and she has scars from the odd accident on construction sites, and Gwen is staring as if Morgana's the most beautiful thing she's ever seen. "I've been dreaming about you since I remembered," Gwen admits quietly. "I've been dreaming about you since I was 12 years old," Morgana says, and Gwen makes a soft, strangled sound and embraces her again. Morgana could cry at the joy and relief in it, but she's too happy even for that. And a moment later, Gwen unclips her bra and murmurs, "Do you remember when I used to undress you? All those lovely gowns with all the laces and ties, and it drove me mad," Morgana whispers, thinking of it. "Your fingers on me, and sometimes when you had a callus from the forge and it would catch on my back just a little, it was like I couldn't breathe. I've got calluses now, only they're mostly from drafting pencils, not—" Morgana grabs Gwen's hand and kisses each of her fingertips. "Good enough," she promises. And it's true, when Gwen's fingers trace over Morgana's breasts, along the soft skin underneath and then up, cupping the weight of them, skimming over the nipples. It's even better than Morgana remembers. Gwen's hands are strong, confident, just rough enough in places to scrape a little, the way Morgana loves. She lets Gwen play with her like that, watches the concentration on Gwen's face, the way her lips move when she wets them, or smiles at one of Morgana's whimpers, or parts them to lean in and lick delicately at Morgana's nipple. And that's too much. That's... Morgana pulls her up, kisses her deeply, and then strips her shirt away. She spares only a moment to stare and then hugs Gwen close again, skin to skin, except where Gwen's bra still separates them, but that's barely even. That's nothing, not with Gwen's nipples standing out under the fabric, and her breath coming quick and ragged, and her body hot under Morgana's hands. She still can't quite believe that this is real, that it's really Gwen soft against her and muttering sweet indecencies in her ear between kisses. But if this is a dream, it's one from which Morgana has no desire to ever wake. It takes no time at all after that to get rid of the rest of their clothes, and then Gwen's pressing Morgana down into the bed, pushing her thigh between Morgana's legs where she's already slick and wet, tangling their bodies together until Morgana can't tell who ends where. She hooks one leg around Gwen's hip and slides her hand between them to find Gwen as wet as she is. And then Gwen gets her own hand on Morgana, and then Morgana's making some spectacularly embarrassing sounds, but she doesn't care at all because it's finally, finally Gwen touching her.
After they've both come, which takes half the time it normally does for Morgana, Gwen trails her fingers, still wet from curling inside Morgana's body, over Morgana's stomach, and says, her voice low and husky, "I still want you to tell me what you remember, and start with the dirty bits." Morgana chuckles, kisses Gwen's nose, and does. "I remember once in the spring after a long winter, you came in with a basket of berries, the first fresh fruit we'd seen, and you laid me out on the table, and you took the berries and balanced them all over my body, on my breasts and my collarbones, and where my hips and ribs stuck out. And then you told me to keep still and parted my legs and said, 'I said anything that was still in place when I was done was yours, but I was eating anything that fell off,'" Gwen supplies, grinning. "I think you weren't very good at keeping still, were you?" "I was doing fine until you'd just been licking me at first, but then you put your fingers in me, two at once out of nowhere, and you bucked up and knocked off the whole lot, yeah? But you shared the berries with me anyway." "Of course, and licked the juice off you as well. You were so pale, with these little red smudges all over you." "Not so pale now."
"No, but just as beautiful," Gwen tells her, completely sincere, and kisses the faint blush from Morgana's cheeks. "What else?" Gwen asks afterward. "In our last lives, when we were in Africa, I was in the Congo last year, and I couldn't stop thinking about that, about you in the jungle." They go on that way, trading memories and touches, pausing in the recollections periodically so Gwen can check to see if Morgana's inner thighs are as sensitive as they once were. They aren't, but the areas where her thighs join her hips are, and Gwen takes full advantage, licking and nibbling and teasing there until Morgana's trembling under her hands and mouth. Or Morgana can count Gwen's vertebrae with her tongue, or they can kiss until they're both panting and desperate, grinding down on one another's hands and groping blindly at breasts and hissing obscene, shattered voice endearments. Several hours later, Morgana falls asleep, sticky and satisfied, and with Gwen snuggled up close to her, their curves slotted together perfectly, even their breathing in sync after a while. Nothing, not even the cat coming in to curl up on their feet, can put a dent in Morgana's happiness. It's a strange feeling, being so thoroughly content. The world's still a mess, sure enough, and she can't remember all she'd like to, and tomorrow she's going to have to get on a train and go back to London, but somehow all of that seems so much more bearable when she's got Gwen mumbling sleepily into her shoulder. In the morning, after they've showered and eaten breakfast, Morgana sits in Gwen's lap and fills a section of her composition book with all the things about them that Gwen recalls and she doesn't. Gwen tells her of a life when they somehow found themselves outlaws, living in the woods and robbing affluent travelers and making love in a rough shelter in a tree. Of a rather ordinary day in their Victorian country house, when Arthur was still in the army in India and Lancelot and Merlin had gone into the city for a day, when they had the place all to themselves. Of the day Morgana left for the front in the Great War, of many other moments, some significant and many meaningful only because they're Gwen's. They only stop when Morgana absolutely has to get to the train station, where Gwen kisses her goodbye and promises to continue next week. She does, and the week after, and the week after that. Morgana lets Merlin look at the composition book sometimes, but she clips these pages together, private, like the sloppy scrawl of her first memories at the start. He doesn't need to see this. No one else needs to see this. It's just Morgana's and Gwen's. When Morgana gets home, she phones Merlin. "I'm sorry about Gwen," she says. "No, you're not," he says, but he sounds more amused than bitter. "Well, no, but I'm sorry for you?" "Thanks, I think. It's fine, Morgana, really. I'm not looking forward to telling people my girlfriend left me for my sister, but apart from that, it's fine. It's not as if you're eloping to Zimbabwe and I'll never see you again." He trails off, and then, sounding suddenly concerned,
You're not eloping to Zimbabwe, right? Homosexuality is illegal in Zimbabwe, Morgana says matter-of-factly. Oh, we could elope to South Africa. Morgana, we're not eloping anywhere, Merlin, she assures him, laughing. Right, good. That's good. Look, I'm coming to London with Gwen next weekend. There's this publishing seminar thing. If you're not too busy shagging, do you think we could all have dinner together Saturday? Of course, I'd like that. Given how gracious Merlin is being about the whole thing, Morgana doesn't actually expect the dinner to be a disaster, but she's still surprised by how easy it all is. Merlin treats her like he always has, and Merlin and Gwen tease each other just like they did before. The only difference is that this time, Gwen is holding Morgana's hand under the table, and Morgana doesn't have to go home alone after. When Merlin hugs Morgana before heading back to his hotel, Gwen calls, "That threesome offer is still on the table, you know." And Merlin laughs and says, "Not in this lifetime," which makes Morgana choke a little because, well, that's more than one kind of true. And then Merlin whispers quietly in her ear, "You take care of her, okay?" And Morgana chokes up a little more and nods and says, "I will. You take care of yourself, all right?" "I'll try," he promises. Merlin hugs Gwen too and whispers something to her that Morgana can't hear, but whatever it is makes Gwen swat him on the shoulder and smile like a sunrise. And it makes Morgana genuinely glad they've had each other for the last few years, that neither of them has been alone in quite the same way she was once. For the rest of the summer, they continue alternating, Gwen coming to London one weekend and Morgana going to Kent the next. Morgana can't really afford all the train fares. But she just learns to love pot noodles and decides she doesn't actually need new underwear. Gwen's only going to take it off her a few seconds after the rest of her clothing anyway, and that's that. Come September, the only thing that changes is that Morgana's going to Southampton on alternate weekends instead of Kent. It's a longer trip and a more expensive one. 2 months after, Morgana, slumped on Gwen's sofa, says, "I really can't take this anymore." What's that? This long distance nonsense. The amount of time and money we're both wasting sitting on trains every weekend. I can't do it anymore. Morgana, Gwen says, looking startled. Please don't tell me that after everything, you're going to dump me over. No, Gwen. I want to move here to Southampton. I'm looking into work. There's a group with an office here that might take me. I'd only need to find a flat. You could move in here. Gwen says, "I mean, I don't know that you'd want to. It's tiny. We'd be practically on top of one another, and it might not be all that convenient here. I'd love to, if you'll have me." "I'll always have you. I'll have you right now, in fact," Gwen says, climbing on top of Morgana on the couch. And Morgana laughs like a little girl, too pleased to do anything else, at least until Gwen's got her too breathless to even laugh. The flat is small and crowded with all of their things in it, but any frustration Morgana may experience on that count melts away instantly whenever Gwen smiles at her, or wanders in with drafting pencils stuck in her hair, or comes home with takeaway from a restaurant ostensibly serving African fare and apologizes because it's probably about as authentic as your average Chinese takeaway. Gwen's parents, who have known about her bisexuality almost as long as Gwen has, love Morgana. Possibly even more than they loved Merlin. Gwen's father claps Morgana on the shoulder and says, "All men are bastards. You're much better off with each other." Gwen's mother rolls her eyes and asks how Morgana feels about the illegal cat. Morgana likes the illegal cat. The cat stays out of the way when she's having sex with Gwen, and in return, Morgana tolerates the cat's demands for food at odd hours of the morning. When they finally tell Morgana and Merlin's parents about their relationship, Mum frowns a bit, but only says, "Does this mean you won't be running off to other continents anymore?" And smiles when Morgana says, "Yes, it probably does." Dad says he's glad they still get to have Gwen in the family. Merlin laughs at them all. After a year, when Gwen's internship has turned into a proper job with a proper salary, they move into a bigger flat where Gwen's illegal cat isn't even illegal. A year after that, Morgana finds herself in a jewelry shop. Staring at engagement rings with her heart in her throat. Hiding the ring isn't difficult.
Gwen has always respected Morgana's privacy, never been one for snooping. She still asks for permission before borrowing Morgana's clothes, even though Morgana says yes every time. So Morgana tucks the ring box into a padded envelope and slides the envelope into the box full of her financial papers and doesn't worry in the slightest about Gwen finding it. That does not, however, mean that she doesn't worry. Even though it's been centuries, even though they've been together for more than 2 years and Gwen hasn't so much as looked at anyone else since breaking things off with Merlin, Morgana's nervous. Because they've always been together, even if Morgana's had to share Gwen with Lancelot or Merlin or Arthur or all of them. But it's never been binding like this, never been official, never been down on paper. If they've married at all, they've married the boys, and they've never even been stepsisters-in-law, because Gwen married Lancelot the last time Morgana was legally related to Arthur. It's never mattered before, but suddenly they can be partners in the eyes of the law, and that's exhilarating and terrifying, and Morgana finds herself seized by insecurity, senselessly scared that Gwen will say no. She dithers about it for a week, taking the ring out to stare at it when Gwen isn't around. And then one day Gwen comes home unexpectedly early. Morgana stuffs the ring into her pocket and goes to greet her. Gwen kisses her gently and says, "Morgana, I've been thinking. How would you feel about a civil partnership? We're practically married as it is. We might as well have the legal benefits. And anyway, I think it would be sort of nice to have a ceremony that's for us for once." And then she trails off because Morgana, speechless, is holding out the ring. "Oh," says Gwen, wide-eyed. She stares for a moment and then claps a hand over her mouth, which is not enough to conceal her great big smile. "I take it that's a yes, then," she says through her fingers. "Yes," Morgana says, her voice a little unsteady. "Yes, it is." The ceremony is non-traditional, to say the least. Merlin essentially serves as best man for the both of them. Morgana wears an elaborate, brightly colored dress made by one of her friends from Mali. Gwen insists on arranging the space herself and wears trousers. They spend half their honeymoon in the south of France, where Morgana tries to do the talking, despite having barely used the language for nearly 3 years, while Gwen snickers quietly, and finally steps forward to take over. Her accent a flawless match for that of the locals. When Morgana stares at her in shock, Gwen grins and says, "I've an aunt who lives in Marseille, remember? I've spent a lot of time in this area." Morgana kisses her, and later persuades her to read aloud from a book of erotic poetry they found in a little shop, and by the end of the night she's lost track of what language Gwen's using when she says, "I love you." They spend the second half of their honeymoon in South Africa. Morgana remembers stepping off a plane in Africa with Gwen in the 60s, and she remembers stepping off a plane in Africa on her own several times in the last 8 years. She's never going to forget stepping off this plane, Gwen holding her hand and gazing around her in sheer awe and, a few hours later, saying, "Yeah, I can see why you liked it here." It's a little strange being back, especially being back as a tourist instead of a worker, but it's good. They do tourist things, take in the scenery, and one night they climb up to the roof of their hotel to see the sunset. Morgana holds Gwen close and watches the sky in silence, overwhelmed by how different, how much improved her life is since the last time she watched an African sunset from a rooftop. When they board their plane home a few days later, Morgana doesn't look back. Part 5. Something to Remember, Indefinitely. One day, some years later, Merlin calls and Gwen answers. "Gwen, is my cock really that offensive?" "I'm sorry?" "Siobhan dumped me. Apparently she's a lesbian now. We had sex twice, and now she's not questioning, not bi, no, she's 100% pure, never want to see a naked man again, lesbian." "Oh, sweetheart. I'm so sorry. How many is that now?" "Three.
Four, if you count Janice, who was bi when we started dating, but left me for a woman and hasn't looked at a man since. Which, this is clearly a pattern, Gwen, so I'm thinking you have first-hand experience, yeah? Am I really that awful? I mean, I thought you liked this sex, but I don't know. Maybe you were just faking it to make me happy. Or maybe there are still magical powers in the world, and mine is to make women hate cock. He trails off when Gwen's attempt at supportive silence derails into full-on laughter. Merlin, I'm sorry, I can't help it. There's nothing wrong with your cock. It's a very nice cock. Just think of it like this. You're helping them to discover what they truly want. And maybe you should try dating men for a while. I'll probably turn them straight, Merlin mutters darkly. Anyway, that never works out. I always end up resenting them for not being Arthur. Yeah, you'll find him, Merlin. You will. And trust me, all of this will be worth it when you do. While this conversation is going on, Morgana is sprawled over the sofa, half listening and utterly content, in a hideously smug way that she can't even begin to feel bad about. She's sorry for Merlin's woes, she really is, and she does hope that Arthur will turn up sooner rather than later, but, she knows exactly what Gwen means by all of this will be worth it when you do. After all the years and tears, after America and Africa, and those mixed-up weeks when she had Gwen but didn't have her, after all her memories and the remarkable bliss of finding them made real, Morgana knows exactly what Gwen means. The no longer illegal cat comes to sit on her feet, and a few minutes after that, Gwen comes to scrunch up beside her. Gwen's been drawing. Her fingers are smudged with ink, and there's a pencil and a pen both stuck into her bun. And when she smiles at Morgana, it's like the sun came out. The end.
Joseph's face was black as night. The pale shone in his eyes. His path was marked by the stars in the southern hemisphere, and he walked his days under Africa's skies. This is the story of how we begin to remember. This is the powerful pulsing of love in the veins. After the dream of falling and calling your name out, these are the roots of rhythm, and the roots of rhythm remain. Pale yellow moon shone in his eyes. His path was marked by the stars in the southern hemisphere, and he walked the length of his days under African skies.